4. Now he surveyed the men of Colubrin Sturgis, not even glancing at George Telford. The feather sagged in Telford's hand. He sat down on the first bench, still holding it.
Callahan began with one of his slang terms, but they were farmers, and no one needed to ask for an explanation.
"This is chicken shit."
He surveyed them longer. Most would not return his look. After a moment, even Eisenhart and Adams dropped their eyes. Overholzer kept his head up, but under the old fellow's hard gaze, the rancher looked petulant rather than defiant.
"Chicken shit,"
the man in the black coat and turned around collar repeated, enunciating each syllable. A small gold cross gleamed below the notch in the backwards collar. On his forehead, that other cross, the one Zelia believed he'd carved in his flesh with his own thumbnail in partial penance for some awful sin, glared under the lamps like a tattoo.
"This young man isn't one of my flock, but he's right, and I think you all know it. You know it in your hearts. Even you, Mr. Overholzer, and you, George Telford."
"No, no such thing," Telford said, but his voice was weak and stripped of its former persuasive charm.
"All your lies will cross your eyes. That's what my mother would have told you."
Callahan offered Telford a thin smile Tian wouldn't have wanted pointed in his direction. And then Callahan did turn to him.
"I never heard it put better than you put it tonight, boy. Thank you, Si."
Tian raised a feeble hand and managed an even more feeble smile. He felt like a character in a silly festival play saved at the last moment by some improbable supernatural intervention.
"I know a bit about cowardice, may it do ya," Callahan said, turning to the men on the benches. He raised his right hand, misshapen and twisted by some old burn, looked at it fixedly, then dropped it to his side again.
"I have personal experience, you might say. I know how one cowardly decision leads to another, and another, and another, until it's too late to turn around, too late to change. Mr. Telford, I assure you the tree of which young Mr. Jafford spoke is not make-believe. The Kala is in dire danger. Your souls are in danger."
"Hail Mary, full of grace," said someone on the left side of the room. "The Lord is with thee. Blessed is the fruit of thy womb,
"Bag it," Callahan snapped. "Save it for Sunday."
His eyes, blue sparks in their deep hollows, studied them.
"For this night, never mind God and Mary and the man Jesus. Never mind the light sticks and the buzz bugs of the wolves either. You must fight. You're the men of the Kala, are you not? Then act like men. Stop behaving like dogs crawling on their bellies to lick the boots of a cruel master."
Overholzer went dark red at that and began to stand. Diego Adams grabbed his arm and spoke in his ear. For a moment, Overholzer remained as he was, frozen in a kind of crouch, and then he sat back down. Adams stood up.
"Sounds good, Padrone," Adams said in his heavy accent. "Sounds brave. Yet there are still a few questions, mayhap. Haycox asked one of him. How can ranchers and farmers stand against armed killers?"
"By hiring armed killers of our own," Callahan replied.
There was a moment of utter, amazed silence. It was almost as if the old fellow had lapsed into another language. At last Diego Adams said cautiously,
"I don't understand."
"Of course you don't," the old fellow said. "So listen and gain wisdom. Rancher Adams and all of you, listen and gain wisdom. Not 6 days' ride nor west of us, and bound southeast along the path of the beam, come 3 gunslingers and 1 prentice."
He smiled at their amazement. Then he turned to Slightman.
"The prentice isn't much older than your boy, Ben, but he's already as quick as a snake and as deadly as a scorpion. The others are quicker and deadlier by far. I have it from Andy, who's seen them. You want hard calibers? They're at hand. I set my watch and warrant on it."
This time Overholzer made it all the way to his feet. His face burned as if with a fever. His great pod of a belly trembled.
"What children's good-night story is this?" he asked. "If there ever were such men, they passed out of existence with Gilead. And Gilead has been dust in the wind for 1,000 years.
There were no mutterings of support or dispute, no mutterings of any kind. The crowd was still frozen, caught in the reverberation of that one mythic word. Gunslingers.
You're wrong, Callahan said. But we don't need to fight over it. We can go and see for ourselves. A small party will do, I think. Jaffet's here, myself. And what about you, Overholzer? Want to come?
There ain't no gunslingers, Overholzer roared.
Behind him, Borge Estrada stood up.
Per Callahan, God's grace on you, and you, Borge. But even if there were gunslingers, how could 3 stand against 40 or 60? And not 40 or 60 normal men, but 40 or 60 wolves. Hear him, he speaks sense.
Eben Took, the storekeeper, called out.
And why would they fight for us? Estrada continued. We make it from year to year, but not much more. What could we offer them beyond a few hot meals? And what man agrees to die for his dinner?
Hear him! Hear him! Telford, Overholzer, and Eisenhart cried in unison. Others stamped rhythmically up and down on the boards. The old fellow waited until the stomping had quit, and then said,
I have books in the rectory. 6.
Although most of them knew this, the thought of books, all that paper, still provoked a general sigh of wonder.
According to one of them, gunslingers were forbidden to take reward, supposedly because they descend from the line of Arthur Eld.
The Eld, the Eld, the Manny whispered, and several raised fists into the air with the first and fourth fingers pointed. Hook'em horns, the old fellow thought. Go Texas! He managed to stifle a laugh, but not the smile that rose on his lips.
Are you speaking of hard cases who wander the land, doing good deeds? Telford asked in a gently mocking voice. Surely you're too old for such tales, Pear?
Not hard cases, Callahan said patiently. Gunslingers. How can 3 men stand against the wolves, Pear?
Tien heard himself ask. According to Andy, one of the gunslingers was actually a woman. But Callahan saw no need to muddy the waters further, although an impish part of him wanted to just the same.
That's a question for their din, Tien. We'll ask him. And they wouldn't just be fighting for their suppers, you know, not at all.
What else, then? Bucky Javier asked.
Callahan thought they would want the thing that lay beneath the floorboards of his church. And that was good, because that thing had awakened. The old fella, who had once run from a town called Jerusalem's Lot in another world, wanted to be rid of it. If he wasn't rid of it soon, it would kill him. Ka had come to Calla Bryn Sturgis. Ka, like a wind.
In time, Mr. Javier, Callahan said. All in good time, Si.
Meantime, a whisper had begun in the gathering hall. It slipped along the benches from mouth to mouth, a breeze of hope and fear. Gunslingers. Gunslingers to the west come out of Midworld. And it was true, God help them. Arthur Eld's last deadly children moving toward Calla Bryn Sturgis along the path of the beam. Ka, like a wind.
Time to be men, Per Callahan told them.
Beneath the scar on his forehead, his eyes burned like lamps. Yet his tone was not without compassion.
Time to stand up, gentlemen. Time to stand and be true.
Part 1. Todash. Chapter 1. The Face on the Water. 1. Time is a face on the water. This was a proverb from the long ago in far-off Magis. Eddie Dean had never been there. Except he had, in a way. Roland had carried all 4 of his companions, Eddie, Susanna, Jake, Oi, to Magis one night, storying long as they camped on I-70, the Kansas Turnpike, in a Kansas that never was. That night he had told them the story of Susan Delgado, his first love, perhaps his only love, and how he had lost her. The saying might have been true when Roland had been a boy not much older than Jake Chambers, But Eddie thought it was even truer now, as the world wound down like the mainspring in an ancient watch. Roland had told them that even such basic things as the points of the compass could no longer be trusted in Midworld. What was dead west today might be southwest tomorrow, crazy as that might seem. And time had likewise begun to soften. There were days Eddie could have sworn were 40 hours long, some of them followed by nights, like the one on which Roland had taken them to Magus, that seemed even longer. Then there would come an afternoon when it seemed you could almost see darkness bloom as night rushed over the horizon to meet you. Eddie wondered if time had gotten lost. They had ridden and riddled out of a city called Ludd on Blaine the Mono. "Blaine is a pain," Jake had said on several occasions, but he, or it, turned out to be quite a bit more than just a pain. Blaine the Mono had been utterly mad. Eddie killed it with illogic. "Something you're just naturally good at, sugar," Susanna told him. And they had detrained in a Topeka which wasn't quite part of the world from which Eddie, Susanna, and Jake had come. Which was good, really, because this world, one in which the Kansas City pro baseball team was called the Monarchs, Coca-Cola was called Nozola, and the big Japanese car maker was Takuro rather than Honda, had been overwhelmed by some sort of plague which had killed damn near everyone. So stick that in your Takuro spirit and drive it, Eddie thought. The passage of time had seemed clear enough to him through all of this. During much of it he'd been scared shitless. He guessed all of them had been, except maybe for Roland. But yes, it had seemed real and clear. He'd not had that feeling of time slipping out of his grasp, even when they'd been walking up I-70 with bullets in their ears, looking at the frozen traffic and listening to the warble of what Roland called a thinny. But after their confrontation in the Glass Palace, with Jake's old friend the TikTok man and Roland's old friend Flag or Martin or just perhaps Marilyn, time had changed.
Not right away, though. We traveled in that damned pink ball, saw Roland kill his mother by mistake, and when we came back...
Yes, that was when it had happened. They had awakened in a clearing perhaps 30 miles from the Green Palace. They had still been able to see it, but all of them had understood that it was in another world. Someone or some force had carried them over or through the thinny and back to the path of the beam. Whoever or whatever it had been, it had actually been considerate enough to pack them each a lunch, complete with Nozola sodas and rather more familiar packages of Keebler cookies. Near them, stuck on the branch of a tree, had been a note from the being Roland had just missed killing in the palace. "Renounce the tower. This is your last warning." Ridiculous, really. Roland would no more renounce the tower than he'd kill Jake's pet Billy Bumbler and then roast him on a spit for dinner. None of them would renounce Roland's dark tower. God help them, they were in it all the way to the end. "We got some daylight left," Eddie had said on the day they'd found Flag's warning note. "You want to use it or what?" "Yes," Roland of Gilead had replied. "Let's use it." And so they had. Following the path of the beam through endless open fields that were divided from each other by belts of straggly, annoying underbrush. There'd been no sign of people. Skies had remained low and cloudy day after day and night after night. Because they followed the path of the beam, the clouds directly above them sometimes roiled and broke open, revealing patches of blue, but never for long. One night they opened long enough to disclose a full moon, with a face clearly visible on it. The nasty, complicitous squint and grin of the peddler. That made it late summer by Roland's reckoning, but to Eddie it looked like half past no time at all. The grass mostly listless or outright dead, the trees, what few there were, bare, the bushes scrubby and brown. There was little game, and for the first time in weeks, since leaving the forest ruled by Shardik, the cyborg bear, they sometimes went to bed with their bellies not quite full. Yet none of that, Eddie thought, was quite as annoying as the sense of having lost hold of time itself. No hours, no days, no weeks, no seasons, for God's sake. The moon might have told Roland it was the end of summer, but the world around them looked like the first week of November, dozing sleepily toward winter. Time, Eddie had decided during this period, was in large part created by external events. When a lot of interesting shit was happening, time seemed to go by fast. If you got stuck with nothing but the usual boring shit, it slowed down, and when everything stopped happening, time apparently quit altogether. Just packed up and went to Coney Island. Weird, but true. Had everything stopped happening? Eddie considered, and with nothing to do but push Susanna's wheelchair through one boring field after another, there was plenty of time for consideration. The only peculiarity he could think of since returning from the wizard's glass was what Jake called the mystery number, and that probably meant nothing. They'd needed to solve a mathematical riddle in the Cradle of Lud in order to gain access to Blaine, and Susanna had suggested the mystery number was a holdover from that. Eddie was far from sure she was right, but hey, it was a theory. And really, what could be so special about the number 19? Mystery number, indeed. After some thought, Susanna had pointed out it was prime, at least, like the numbers that had opened the gate between them and Blaine the Mono. Eddie had added that it was the only one that came between 18 and 20 every time you counted. Jake had laughed at that and told him to stop being a jerk. Eddie, who had been sitting close to the campfire and carving a rabbit, when it was done it would join the cat and dog already in his pack, told Jake to quit making fun of his only real talent. 2. They might have been back on the path of the beam 5 or 6 weeks when they came to a pair of ancient double ruts that had surely once been a road. They didn't follow the path of the beam exactly, but Roland swung them onto it anyway. It bore closely enough to the beam for their purposes, he said. Eddie thought being on a road again might refocus things, help them to shake that maddening, becalmed-in-the-horse-latitudes feeling, but it didn't. The road carried them up and across a rising series of fields like steps. They finally topped a long north-south ridge. On the far side, their road descended into a dark wood. Almost a fairy-tale wood, Eddie thought, as they passed into its shadows. Susanna shot a small deer on their second day in the forest. Or maybe it was the third day, or the fourth. And the meat was delicious after a steady diet of vegetarian gunslinger burritos, but there were no orcs or trolls in the deep glades, and no elves, Keebler or otherwise. No more deer, either. "I keep looking for the candy house," Eddie said. They'd been winding their way through the great old trees for several days by then, or maybe it had been as long as a week. All he knew for sure was that they were still reasonably close to the path of the beam. They could see it in the sky, and they could feel it. "What candy house is this?" Roland asked. "Is it another tale? If so, I'd hear." Of course he would. The man was a glutton for stories, especially those that led off with a once upon a time when everyone lived in the forest. But the way he listened was a little odd, a little off. Eddie had mentioned this to Susanna once, and she'd nailed it with a single stroke, as she often did. Susanna had a poet's almost uncanny ability to put feelings into words, freezing them in place. "That's 'cause he doesn't listen all big-eyed like a kid at bedtime," she said. "That's just how you want him to listen, Honeybunch." "And how does he listen?" "Like an anthropologist," she had replied promptly. "Like an anthropologist trying to figure out some strange culture by their myths and legends." She was right, and if Roland's way of listening made Eddie uncomfortable, it was probably because in his heart Eddie felt that if anyone should be listening like scientists, it should be him and Suze and Jake, because they came from a far more sophisticated where and when, didn't they? Whether they did or didn't, the four had discovered a great number of stories that were common to both worlds. Roland knew a tale called Diana's Dream that was eerily close to The Lady or the Tiger, which all three exiled New Yorkers had read in school. The tale of Lord Perth was similar to the Bible story of David and Goliath. Roland had heard many tales of the man Jesus, who died on the cross to redeem the sins of the world, and told Eddie, Susanna, and Jake that Jesus had his fair share of followers in Midworld. There were also songs common to both worlds. Careless Love was one, Hey Jude was another, although in Roland's world, the first line of this song was, Hey Jude, I see you, lad. Eddie passed at least an hour telling Roland the story of Hansel and Gretel, turning the wicked child-eating witch into Rhea of the Coos almost without thinking of it. When he got to the part about her trying to fatten the children up, he broke off and asked Roland, Do you know this one? A version of this one? No, Roland said, but it's a fair tale. Tell it to the end, please. Eddie did, finishing with the required They Lived Happily Ever After, and the gunslinger nodded, No one ever does live happily ever after. But we leave the children to find that out for themselves, don't we? Yeah, Jake said. Oi was trotting at the boy's heel, looking up at Jake with the usual expression of calm adoration in his gold-ringed eyes.
Yeah,
the bumbler said, copying the boy's rather glum inflection exactly. Eddie threw an arm around Jake's shoulders.
Too bad you're over here instead of back in New York, he said. If you were back in the Apple, Jakey boy, you'd probably have your own child psychiatrist by now. You'd be working on these issues about your parents, getting to the heart of your unresolved conflicts. Maybe getting some good drugs, too, Ritalin, stuff like that.
On the whole, I'd rather be here, Jake said, and looked down at Oi.
Yeah, Eddie said, I don't blame you.
Such stories are called fairy tales, Roland mused.
Yeah.
Eddie replied. There were no fairies in this one, though.
No, Eddie agreed. That's more like a category name than anything else. In our world, you got your mystery and suspense stories, your science fiction stories, your westerns, your fairy tales, get it?
Yes, Roland said. Do people in your world always want only one story flavor at a time? Only one taste in their mouths?
I guess that's close enough, Susanna said.
Does no one eat stew? Roland asked.
Sometimes at supper, I guess, Eddie said. But when it comes to entertainment, we do tend to stick with one flavor at a time and don't let any one thing touch another thing on your plate. Although it sounds kind of boring when you put it that way.
How many of these fairy tales would you say there are?
With no hesitation, and certainly no collusion, Eddie, Susanna, and Jake all said the same word at exactly the same time. 19.
And a moment later, Oi repeated it in his hoarse voice,
19.
They looked at each other and laughed, because 19 had become a kind of jokey catchword among them, replacing bum-hug, which Jake and Eddie had pretty much worn out. Yet the laughter had a tinge of uneasiness about it, because this business about 19 had gotten a trifle weird. Eddie had found himself carving it on the side of his most recent wooden animal, like a brand. Hey there, pard, welcome to our spread. We call it the Bar 19. Both Susanna and Jake had confessed to bringing wood for the evening fire in armloads of 19 pieces. Neither of them could say why. It just felt right to do it that way, somehow. Then there was the morning Roland had stopped them at the edge of the wood through which they were now traveling. He had pointed at the sky, where one particularly ancient tree had reared its hoary branches. The shape those branches made against the sky was the number 19. Clearly 19. They had all seen it, but Roland had seen it first. Yet Roland, who believed in omens and portents as routinely as Eddie had once believed in light bulbs and AA batteries, had a tendency to dismiss his quartet's odd and sudden infatuation with the number. They had grown close, he said, as close as any quartet could, and so their thoughts, habits, and little obsessions had a tendency to spread among them all like a cold. He believed that Jake was facilitating this to a certain degree.
"You've got the touch, Jake," he said. "I'm not sure that it's as strong in you as it was in my old friend, Alain. But by the gods, I believe it may be."
"I don't know what you're talking about," Jake had replied, frowning in puzzlement.
Eddie did, sort of, and guessed that Jake would know in time. If time ever began passing in a normal way again, that was. And on the day Jake brought the muffin balls, It did. 3. They had stopped for lunch. More uninteresting vegetarian burritos. The deer meat now gone and the Keebler cookies little more than a sweet memory. When Eddie noticed that Jake was gone and asked the gunslinger if he knew where the kid had gotten off to. "Peeled off about half a wheel back," Roland said, and pointed along the road with the two remaining fingers of his right hand. "He's all right. If he wasn't, we'd all feel it." Roland looked at his burrito, then took an unenthusiastic bite. Eddie opened his mouth to say something else, but Susanna got there first.
"Here he is now. Hi there, sugar. What you got?"
Jake's arms were full of round things the size of tennis balls. Only these balls would never bounce, true. They had little horns sticking up from them. When the kid got closer, Eddie could smell them, and the smell was wonderful, like fresh baked bread.
"I think these might be good to eat," Jake said. "They smell like the fresh sourdough bread my mother and Mrs. Shaw, the housekeeper, got at Zabar's."
He looked at Susanna and Eddie, smiling a little.
"Do you guys know Zabar's?"
"I sure do," Susanna said. "Best of everything, mm-mm, and they do smell fine.
You didn't eat any yet, did you?"
"No way,"
he looked questioningly at Roland. The gunslinger ended the suspense by taking one, plucking off the horns, and biting into what was left.
"Muffin balls," he said. "I haven't seen any in God's know how long. They're wonderful." His blue eyes were gleaming. "Don't want to eat the horns. They're not poison, but they're sour. We can fry them if there's a little deer fat left. That way they taste almost like meat."
"Sounds like a good idea," Eddie said. "Knock yourself out. As for me, I think I'll skip the mushroom muff divers or whatever they are."
"They're not mushrooms at all," Roland said. "More like a kind of ground berry."
Susanna took one, nibbled, then helped herself to a bigger bite.
"You don't want to skip these, sweetheart," she said. "My daddy's friend, Pop Mose, would have said, these are prime."
She took another of the muffin balls from Jake and ran a thumb over its silky surface.
"Maybe," he said. "But there was this book I read for a report back in high school. I think it was called We Have Always Lived in the Castle, where this nutty chick poisoned her whole family with things like that."
He bent toward Jake, raising his eyebrows and stretching the corners of his mouth in what he hoped was a creepy smile.
"Poisoned her whole family, and they died in agony."
Eddie fell off the log on which he had been sitting and began to roll around on the needles and fallen leaves, making horrible faces and choking sounds. Oi ran around him, yipping Eddie's name in a series of high-pitched barks.
"Quit it," Roland said. "Where did you find these, Jake?"
"Back there," he said. "In a clearing I spotted from the path. It's full of these things. Also, if you guys are hungry for meat, I know I am, there's all kinds of sign. A lot of the scat's fresh."
His eyes searched Roland's face.
"Very fresh scat."
He spoke slowly, as if to someone who wasn't fluent in the language. A little smile played at the corners of Roland's mouth.
"Speak quiet, but speak plain," he said. "What worries you, Jake?"
When Jake replied, his lips barely made the shapes of the words.
"Men watching me while I pick the muffin balls."
He paused, then added,
"They're watching us now."
Susanna took one of the muffin balls, admired it, then dipped her face as if to smell it like a flower.
"Back the way we came? To the right of the road?"
"Yes," Jake said.
Eddie raised a curled fist to his mouth as if to stifle a cough and said,
"How many?"
"I think 4.
5,
Roland said.
"Possibly as many as 6. One's a woman. Another a boy not much older than Jake."
Jake looked at him, startled. Eddie said,
"How long have they been there?"
"Since yesterday," Roland said. "Cut in behind us from almost dead east."
"And you didn't tell us?"
Susanna asked. She spoke rather sternly, not bothering to cover her mouth and obscure the shapes of the words. Roland looked at her with the barest twinkle in his eye.
"I was curious as to which of you would smell them out first. Actually, I had my money on you, Susanna."
She gave him a cool look and said nothing. Eddie thought there was more than a little dead a walker in that look, and was glad not to be on the receiving end.
"What do we do about them?" Jake asked.
"For now, nothing," the gunslinger said.
Jake clearly didn't like this.
What if they're like TikTok's Quartet, Gasher and Hoots and those guys?
They're not.
How do you know?
Because they would have set on us already, and they'd be fly food. There seemed no good reply to that, and they took to the road again. It wound through deep shadows, finding its way among trees that were centuries old. Before they had been walking 20 minutes, Eddie heard the sound of their pursuers, or shadowers, snapping twigs, rustling underbrush, once even a low voice. Slew feet, in Roland's terminology. Eddie was disgusted with himself for remaining unaware of them for so long. He also wondered what yon cullies did for a living. If it was tracking and trapping, they weren't very good at it. Eddie Dean had become a part of Midworld in many ways, some so subtle he wasn't consciously aware of them, but he still thought of distances in miles instead of wheels. He guessed they'd come about 15 from the spot where Jake rejoined them with his muffin balls and his news when Roland called it a day. They stopped in the middle of the road, as they always did since entering the forest. That way the embers of their campfire stood little chance of setting the woods on fire. Eddie and Susanna gathered a nice selection of fallen branches, while Roland and Jake made a little camp and set about cutting up Jake's trove of muffin balls. Susanna rolled her wheelchair effortlessly over the duff under the ancient trees, piling her selections in her lap. Eddie walked nearby, humming under his breath. "Look it over to your left, sugar," Susanna said. He did, and saw a distant orange blink. A fire. "Not very good, are they?" he asked. "No. Truth is, I feel a little sorry for him." "Any idea what they're up to?" "But I think Roland's right. They'll tell us when they're ready. Either that or decide we're not what they want and just sort of fade away. Come on, let's go back." "Just a second." He picked up one more branch, hesitated, then took yet another. Then it was right. "Okay," he said. As they headed back, he counted the sticks he'd picked up, then the ones in Susanna's lap. The total came to 19 in each case. "Suze," he said, and when she glanced over at him, time started up again. She didn't ask him what he meant, only nodded. 4. Eddie's resolution about not eating the muffin balls didn't last long. They just smelled too damn good sizzling in a lump of deer fat Roland, thrifty, murderous soul that he was, had saved away in his scuffed old purse. Eddie took his share on one of the ancient plates they'd found in Shardik's woods and gobbled them. "These are as good as lobster," he said, then remembered the monsters on the beach that had eaten Roland's fingers. "As good as Nathan's hot dog is what I meant to say, and I'm sorry for teasing you, Jake."
"Don't worry about it," Jake said, smiling. "You never tease hard."
"One thing you should be aware of," Roland said. He was smiling. He smiled more these days, quite a lot more, but his eyes were serious. "All of you. Muffin balls sometimes bring very lively dreams."
"You mean they make you stoned?" Jake asked, rather uneasily. He was thinking of his father. Elmer Chambers had enjoyed many of the weirder things in life.
"Stoned? I'm not sure.
Buzzed. High. Seeing things. Like when you took the mescaline and went into the stone circle where that thing almost, you know, almost hurt me?"
Roland paused for a moment, remembering. There had been a kind of succubus imprisoned in that ring of stones. Left to its own devices, she undoubtedly would have initiated Jake Chambers sexually, then fucked him to death. As matters turned out, Roland had made it speak. To punish him, it had sent him a vision of Susan Delgado.
"Roland?"
Jake was looking at him anxiously. "Don't concern yourself, Jake. There are mushrooms that do what you're thinking of, change consciousness, heighten it, but not muffin balls. These are berries, just good to eat. If your dreams are particularly vivid, just remind yourself you are dreaming." Eddie thought this a very odd little speech. For one thing, it wasn't like Roland to be so tenderly solicitous of their mental health. Not like him to waste words, either. "Things have started again, and he knows it, too," Eddie thought. There was a little time out there, but now the clock's running again. Game on, as they say.
We going to set a watch, Roland? Eddie asked.
Not by my warrant, the gunslinger said comfortably, and began rolling himself a smoke.
You really don't think they're dangerous, do you?
Susanna said, and raised her eyes to the woods, where the individual trees were now losing themselves in the general gloom of evening. The little spark of campfire they'd noticed earlier was now gone, but the people following them were still there. Susanna felt them when she looked down at Oi and saw him gazing in the same direction. She wasn't surprised.
I think that may be their problem, Roland said.
What's that supposed to mean? Eddie asked, but Roland would say no more. He simply lay in the road with a rolled-up piece of deerskin beneath his neck, looking up at the dark sky and smoking.
Later, Roland's quartet slept. They posted no watch and were undisturbed. 5. The dreams, when they came, were not dreams at all. They all knew this except perhaps for Susanna, who in a very real sense was not there at all that night.
I'm back in New York, Eddie thought. And on the heels of this, really back in New York, this is really happening.
It was. He was in New York, on Second Avenue. That was when Jake and Oi came around the corner from 54th Street.
Hey, Eddie, Jake said, grinning. Welcome home.
Game on, Eddie thought. Game on. Chapter 2. New York Groove. 1. Jake fell asleep looking into pure darkness. No stars in that cloudy night sky, no moon. As he drifted off, he had a sensation of falling that he recognized with dismay. In his previous life, as a so-called normal child, he'd often had dreams of falling, especially around exam time, but these had ceased since his violent rebirth into Midworld. Then, the falling feeling was gone. He heard a brief, chiming melody that was somehow too beautiful. 3 notes, and you wanted it to stop. 12, and you thought it would kill you if it didn't. Each chime seemed to make his bones vibrate. Sounds Hawaiian, doesn't it, he thought, for although the chiming melody was nothing like the sinister warble of the thinny, somehow it was. It was. Then, just when he truly believed he could bear it no longer, the terrible, gorgeous tune stopped. The darkness behind his closed eyes suddenly lit up a brilliant dark red. He opened them cautiously on strong sunlight and gaped at New York. Taxis bustled past, gleaming bright yellow in the sunshine. A young black man wearing Walkman earphones strolled by Jake, bopping his sandaled feet a little bit to the music and going cha-da-bow, cha-da-bow under his breath. A jackhammer battered Jake's eardrums. Chunks of cement dropped into a dump truck with a crash that echoed from one cliff face of buildings to another. The world was adin with racket. He had gotten used to the deep silences of Midworld without even realizing it. No more had come to love them. Still, this noise and bustle had its attractions, and Jake couldn't deny it. Back in the New York groove, he felt a little grin stretch his lips.
Ache, ache! Cried a low, rather distressed voice.
Jake looked down and saw Oi sitting on the sidewalk with his tail curled neatly around him. The Billy Bumbler wasn't wearing little red booties, and Jake wasn't wearing the red Oxfords, thank God. But this was still very like their visit to Roland's Gilead, which they had reached by traveling in the pink wizard's glass. The glass ball that had caused so much trouble and woe. No glass this time. He'd just gone to sleep. But this was no dream. It was more intense than any dream he'd ever had, and more textured. Also, people kept detouring around him and Oi as they stood to the left of a midtown saloon called Kansas City Blues. While Jake was making this observation, a woman actually stepped over Oi, hitching up her straight black skirt a bit at the knee in order to do so. Her preoccupied face, "I'm just one more New Yorker minding my business, so don't screw with me," was what that face said to Jake, never changed. They don't see us, but somehow they sense us. And if they can sense us, we must really be here. The first logical question was, why? Jake considered this for a moment, then decided to table it. He had an idea the answer would come. Meantime, why not enjoy New York while he had it? Come on, Oi, he said, and walked around the corner. The Billy Bumbler, clearly no city boy, walked so close to him that Jake could feel his breath feathering against his ankle. Second Avenue, he thought. Then, my God. Before he could finish the thought, he saw Eddie Dean standing outside of the Barcelona luggage store, looking dazed and more than a little out of place in old jeans, a deerskin shirt, and deerskin moccasins. His hair was clean, but it hung to his shoulders in a way that suggested no professional had seen to it in quite some time. Jake realized he himself didn't look much better. He was also wearing a deerskin shirt, and on his lower half, the battered remains of the Dockers he'd had on the day he left home for good, setting sail for Brooklyn, Dutch Hill, and another world. Good thing no one can see us, Jake thought, then decided that wasn't true. If people could see them, they'd probably get rich on spare change before noon. The thought made him grin. Hey, Eddie, he said. Welcome home. Eddie nodded, looking bemused. See, you brought your friend. Jake reached down and gave Oi an affectionate pat. He's my version of the American Express card. I don't go home without him. Jake was about to go on. He felt witty, bubbly, full of amusing things to say, when someone came around the corner, passed them without looking, as everyone else had, and changed everything. It was a kid wearing Dockers that looked like Jake's because they were Jake's. Not the pair he had on now, but they were his, all right, so were the sneakers. They were the ones Jake had lost in Dutch Hill. The plaster man who guarded the door between the worlds had torn them right off his feet. The boy who had just passed them was John Chambers. It was him, only this version looked soft and innocent and painfully young. How did you survive? He asked his own retreating back. How did you survive the mental stress of losing your mind and running away from home in that horrible house in Brooklyn? Most of all, how did you survive the doorkeeper? You must be tougher than you look. Eddie did a double take, so comical that Jake laughed in spite of his own shocked surprise. It made him think of those comic book panels where Archie or Jughead is trying to look in two directions at the same time. He looked down and saw a similar expression on Oi's face. Somehow that made the whole thing even funnier. What the fuck? Eddie asked.
Instant replay, Jake said, and laughed harder. It came out sounding goofy as shit, but he didn't care. He felt goofy. It's like when we watched Roland in the Great Hall of Gilead, only this is New York and it's May 31st, 1977. It's the day I took French leave from Piper. Instant replay, baby.
French? Eddie began, but Jake didn't give him a chance to finish. He was struck by another realization, except struck was too mild a word. He was buried by it. Like a man who just happens to be on the beach when a tidal wave rolls in. His face blazed so brightly that Eddie actually took a step back.
The rose, he whispered.
He felt too weak in the diaphragm to speak any louder, and his throat was as dry as a sandstorm.
Eddie, the rose.
What about it?
This is the day I see it.
He reached out and touched Eddie's forearm with a trembling hand.
I go to the bookstore, then to the vacant lot. I think there used to be a delicatessen.
Eddie was nodding and beginning to look excited himself.
Tom and Jerry's Artistic Deli, corner of 2nd and 46th.
The deli's gone, but the rose is there. That me walking down the street is going to see it, and we can see it too. At that, Eddie's own eyes blazed.
Come on, then, he said. We don't want to lose you, him, whoever the fuck.
Don't worry, Jake said. I know where he's going. 2. The Jake ahead of them, New York Jake, spring of 1977 Jake, walked slowly, looking everywhere, clearly digging the day. Mid-world, Jake remembered exactly how that boy had felt, the sudden relief when the arguing voices in his mind, I died. I didn't. had finally stopped their squabbling. Back by the board fence that had been, where the two businessmen had been playing tic-tac-toe with a Mark Cross pen, and of course there had been the relief of being away from the Piper school and the insanity of his final essay for Miss Avery's English class. The final essay counted a full 25% toward each student's final grade. Miss Avery had made that perfectly clear, and Jake's had been gibberish. The fact that his teacher had later given him an A-plus on it didn't change that, only made it clear that it wasn't just him. The whole world was losing its shit, going 19. Being out from under all that, even for a little while, had been great. Of course he was digging the day. Only the day's not quite right, Jake thought, the Jake walking along behind his old self. Something about it. He looked around, but couldn't figure it out. Late May, bright summer sun, lots of strollers and window shoppers on Second Avenue, plenty of taxis, the occasional long black limo. Nothing wrong with any of this. Except there was. Everything was wrong with it. 3. Eddie felt the kid twitch his sleeve. "What's wrong with this picture?" Jake asked. Eddie looked around. In spite of his own adjustment problems, his involved coming back to a New York that was clearly a few years behind his win, he knew what Jake meant. Something was wrong. He looked down at the sidewalk, suddenly sure he wouldn't have a shadow. They'd lost their shadows like the kids in one of the stories, one of the 19 fairy tales, or was it maybe something newer, like The Lion, The Witch, and The Wardrobe, or Peter Pan, one of what might be called the modern 19? Didn't matter in any case, because their shadows were there. Shouldn't be, though, Eddie thought. Shouldn't be able to see our shadows when it's this dark. Stupid thought. It wasn't dark. It was morning, for Christ's sake. A bright May morning, sunshine winking off the chrome of passing cars and the windows of the stores on the east side of Second Avenue, brightly enough to make you squint your eyes. Yet still it seemed somehow dark to Eddie, as if all this were nothing but fragile surface, like the canvas backdrop of a stage set. At Rise we see the Forest of Arden, or a castle in Denmark, or the kitchen of Willie Loman's house. In this case we see Second Avenue, Midtown, New York. Yes, like that, only behind this canvas you wouldn't find the workshop and storage areas of backstage, but only a great, bulging darkness, some vast, dead universe where Roland's tower had already fallen. Please let me be wrong, Eddie thought. Please let this just be a case of culture shock or the plain old heebie-jeebies. He didn't think it was. How'd we get here? He asked Jake. There was no door. He trailed off and then asked with some hope, maybe it is a dream? No, Jake said. It's more like when we traveled in the wizard's glass, except this time there was no ball. A thought struck him. Did you hear music, though? Chimes? Just before you wound up here? Eddie nodded. It was sort of overwhelming, made my eyes water. Right, Jake said. Exactly. Hoy sniffed a fire hydrant. Eddie and Jake paused to let the little guy lift his leg and add his own notice to what was undoubtedly an already crowded bulletin board. Ahead of them, that other Jake, kid 77, was still walking slowly and gawking everywhere. To Eddie, he looked like a tourist from Michigan. He even craned up to see the tops of the buildings, and Eddie had an idea that if the New York Board of Cynicism caught you doing that, they took away your Bloomingdale's charge card. Not that he was complaining. It made the kid easy to follow. And just as Eddie was thinking that, kid 77 disappeared. Where'd you go? Christ, where'd you go? Relax, Jake said. At his ankle, Oi added his 2 cents worth. Axe! The kid was grinning. I just went into the bookstore, the, Manhattan Restaurant of the Mind, it's called. Where you got Charlie the Choo-Choo in the riddle book? Right. Eddie loved the mystified, dazzled grin Jake was wearing. It lit up his whole face. Remember how excited Roland got when I told him the owner's name? Eddie did. The owner of the Manhattan Restaurant of the Mind was a fellow named Calvin Tower. Hurry up, Jake said. I want to watch. Eddie didn't have to be asked twice. He wanted a watch, too. 4. Jake stopped in the doorway to the bookstore. His smile didn't fade exactly, but it faltered.
"What is it?" Eddie asked. "What's wrong?"
"Dunno. Something's different, I think. It's just so much has happened since I was here."
He was looking at the chalkboard in the window, which Eddie thought was actually a very clever way of selling books. It looked like the sort of thing you saw in diners, or maybe the fish markets. "Today's specials. From Mississippi, pan-fried William Faulkner, hardcovers, market price, vintage library paperbacks, 75 cents each. From Maine, chilled Stephen King, hardcovers, market price, book club bargains, paperbacks, 75 cents each. From California, hard-boiled Raymond Chandler, hardcovers, market price, paperbacks, 7 for $5. Eddie looked beyond this and saw that other Jake, the one without the tan or the look of hard clarity in his eyes, standing at a small display table. Kiddie books. Probably both the 19 fairy tales and the modern 19. "Quit it," he told himself. "That's obsessive-compulsive crap, and you know it." Maybe, but good old Jake 77 was about to make a purchase from that table, which had gone on to change and very likely to save their lives. He'd worry about the number 19 later, or not at all, if he could manage it. "Come on," he told Jake. "Let's go in." The boy hung back. "What's the matter?" Eddie asked. "Tower won't be able to see us, if that's what you're worried about."
"Tower won't be able to," Jake said. "But what if he can?"
He pointed at his other self, the one who had yet to meet Gasher and TikTok and the old people of River Crossing, the one who had yet to meet Blaine the Mono and Rhea of the Coos. Jake was looking at Eddie with a kind of haunted curiosity.
"What if I see myself?"
Eddie supposed that might really happen. Hell, anything might happen. But that didn't change what he felt in his heart. "I think we're supposed to go in, Jake."
"Yeah."
It came out in a long sigh.
"I do too."
5. They went in, and they weren't seen, and Eddie was relieved to count 21 books on the display table that had attracted the boy's notice. Except, of course, when Jake picked up the two he wanted, Charlie the Choo-Choo and the Riddle Book, that left 19.
"Find something, son?"
a mild voice inquired. It was a fat fellow in an open-throated white shirt. Behind him, at a counter that looked as if it might have been filched from a turn-of-the-century soda fountain, a trio of old guys were drinking coffee and nibbling pastries. A chessboard with a game in progress sat on the marble counter.
"The guy sitting on the end is Aaron Deepnow," Jake whispered. "He's going to explain the riddle about Samson to me."
"Shh," Eddie said. He wanted to hear the conversation between Calvin Tower and Kid 77. All of a sudden, that seemed very important. Only why was it so fucking dark in here? Except it's not dark at all. The east side of the street gets plenty of sun at this hour, and with the door open, this place is getting all of it. How can you say it's dark? Because it somehow was. The sunlight, the contrast of the sunlight only made it worse. The fact that you couldn't exactly see that darkness made it worse still. And Eddie realized a terrible thing. These people were in danger. Tower, Deepnow, Kid 77, probably him and Midworld, Jake and Oi as well. All of them. 6. Jake watched his other, younger self take a step back from the bookshop owner, his eyes widening in surprise. "Because his name is Tower," Jake thought. "That's what surprised me. Not because of Roland's Tower, though. I didn't know about that yet. But because of the picture I put on the last page of my final essay." He had pasted a photo of the Leaning Tower of Pisa on the last page, then had scribbled all over it with a black Crayola, darkening it as best he could. Tower asked him his name. 77 Jake told him, and Tower joked around with him a little. It was good joking around, the kind you got from adults who really didn't mind kids.
"Good handle, pard," Tower was saying. "Sounds like the footloose hero in a Western novel, the guy who blows into Black Fork, Arizona, cleans up the town, and then travels on. Something by Wayne D. Overholzer, maybe.
Jake took a step closer to his old self. Part of him was thinking what a wonderful sketch all this would make on Saturday Night Live. And his eyes widened slightly.
Eddie!
He was still whispering, although he knew the people in the bookstore couldn't. Except, maybe on some level they could. He remembered the lady back on 54th Street twitching her skirt up at the knee so she could step over Oi, and now Calvin Towers' eyes shifted slightly in his direction before going back to the other version of him.
"Might be good not to attract unnecessary attention," Eddie muttered in his ear.
"I know," Jake said, "but look at Charlie the Choo-Choo, Eddie."
Eddie did, and for a moment saw nothing. Except for Charlie himself, of course. Charlie, with his headlight eye and not-quite-trustworthy cowcatcher grin. Then Eddie's eyebrows went up.
"I thought Charlie the Choo-Choo was written by a lady named Beryl Evans," he whispered.
Jake nodded.
"I did, too."
"Then who's this..." Eddie took another look. "Who's this Claudia E. Inez Backman?"
"I have no idea," Jake said. "I never heard of her in my life."
7. One of the old men at the counter came sauntering toward them. Eddie and Jake drew away. As they stepped back, Eddie's spine gave a cold little wrench. Jake was very pale, and Oi was giving out a series of low, distressed whines. Something was wrong here, all right. In a way, they had lost their shadows. Eddie just didn't know how. Kid 77 had taken out his wallet and was paying for the two books. There was some more talk and good-natured laughter, then he headed for the door. When Eddie started after him, mid-whirl, Jake grabbed his arm.
"No, not yet. I come back in."
"I don't care if you alphabetize the whole place," Eddie said. "Let's wait out on the sidewalk."
Jake thought about this, biting his lip, then nodded. They headed for the door, then stopped, and moved aside as the other Jake returned. The riddle book was open. Calvin Tower had lumbered over to the chessboard on the counter. He looked around with an amiable smile.
"Change your mind about that cup of coffee, oh Hyperborean wanderer?"
"No, I wanted to ask you—"
"This is the part about Samson's riddle," Midworld Jake said. "I don't think it matters, although the Deepno guy sings a pretty good song if you want to hear it."
"I'll pass," Eddie said. "Come on."
They went out. And although things on Second Avenue were still wrong, that sense of endless dark behind the scenes, behind the very sky, it was somehow better than in the Manhattan restaurant of the mind. At least, there was fresh air.
"Tell you what," Jake said, "let's go down to 2nd and 46th right now."
He jerked his head toward the version of him listening to Aaron Deepno sing,
"I'll catch up with us."
Eddie considered it, then shook his head. Jake's face fell a little.
"Don't you want to see the rose?"
"You bet your ass I do," Eddie said. "I'm wild to see it."
"Then?"
"I don't feel like we're done here yet. I don't know why, but I don't."
Jake, the Kid 77 version of him, had left the door open when he went back inside, and now Eddie moved into it. Aaron Deepno was telling Jake a riddle they would later try on Blaine the Mono. What can run but never walks, has a mouth but never talks? Midworld Jake, meanwhile, was once more looking at the notice board in the bookstore window, pan-fried William Faulkner, hard-boiled Raymond Chandler. He wore a frown of the kind that expresses doubt and anxiety rather than ill temper.
"That sign's different, too," he said.
"How?"
"I can't remember."
"Is it important?"
Jake turned to him. The eyes below the furrowed brow were haunted.
"I don't know. It's another riddle. I hate riddles."
Eddie sympathized. When is a Beryl not a Beryl?
"When it's a Claudia," he said.
"Huh?
Never mind. Better step back, Jake, or you're going to run into yourself."
Jake gave the oncoming version of John Chambers a startled glance, then did as Eddie suggested. And when Kid 77 started on down Second Avenue with his new books in his left hand, Midworld Jake gave Eddie a tired smile.
"I do remember one thing," he said. "When I left this bookstore, I was sure I'd never come here again. But I did."
"Considering that we're more ghosts than people, I'd say that's debatable."
Eddie gave the back of Jake's neck a friendly scruff.
And if you have forgotten something important, Roland might be able to help you remember. He's good at that.
Jake grinned at this, relieved. He knew from personal experience that the gunslinger really was good at helping people remember. Roland's friend Alan might have been the one with the strongest ability to touch other minds, and his friend Cuthbert had gotten all the sense of humor in that particular quartet, but Roland had developed over the years into one hell of a hypnotist. He could have made a fortune in Las Vegas.
"Can we follow me now?" Jake asked. "Check out the rose?"
He looked up and down Second Avenue, a street that was somehow bright and dark at the same time, with a kind of unhappy perplexity. "Things are probably better there. The rose makes everything better." Eddie was about to say okay when a dark, gray Lincoln Town car pulled up in front of Calvin Towers' bookshop. It parked by the yellow curb in front of a fire hydrant with absolutely no hesitation. The front doors opened, and when Eddie saw who was getting out from behind the wheel, he seized Jake's shoulder.
"Ow!" Jake said. "Man, that hurts!"
Eddie paid no attention. In fact, the hand on Jake's shoulder clamped down even tighter.
"Christ!"
Eddie whispered.
"Dear Jesus Christ, what's this? What in hell is this?"
8. Jake watched Eddie go past pale to ashy gray. His eyes were bulging from their sockets. Not without difficulty, Jake pried the clamping hand off his shoulder. Eddie made as if to point with that hand, but didn't seem to have the strength. It fell against the side of his leg with a little thump. The man who had gotten out on the passenger side of the town car walked around to the sidewalk while the driver opened the rear curbside door. Even to Jake, their moves looked practiced, almost like steps in a dance. The man who got out of the back seat was wearing an expensive suit, but that didn't change the fact that he was basically a dumpy little guy with a pot belly and black hair going gray around the edges. Dandruffy black hair from the look of his suit's shoulders. To Jake, the day suddenly felt darker than ever. He looked up to see if the sun had gone behind a cloud. It hadn't, but it almost seemed to him that there was a black corona forming around its brilliant circle, like a ring of mascara around a startled eye. Half a block farther downtown, the 1977 version of him was glancing in the window of a restaurant, and Jake could remember the name of it, Choo Choo Mama's. Not far beyond it was Tower of Power Records, where he would think towers are selling cheap today. If that version of him had looked back, he would have seen the gray town car. But he hadn't. Kid 77's mind was fixed firmly on the future.
"It's Balazar," Eddie said.
"What?" Eddie was pointing at the dumpy guy who had paused to adjust his sulca tie. The other two now stood flanking him. They looked simultaneously relaxed and watchful.
"Enrico Balazar, and looking much younger. God, he's almost middle-aged."
"It's 1977, Jake reminded him. Then, as the penny dropped,
"That's the guy you and Roland killed?"
Eddie had told Jake the story of the shootout at Balazar's club in 1987, leaving out the gorier parts. The part, for instance, where Kevin Blake had lobbed the head of Eddie's brother into Balazar's office in an effort to flush Eddie and Roland into the open. Henry Dean, the great sage and eminent junkie.
"Yeah," Eddie said, "the guy Roland and I killed. And the one who was driving, that's Jack Endolini. Old Double Ugly, people used to call him, although never to his face. He went through one of those doors with me just before the shooting started."
"Roland killed him too, didn't he?" Eddie nodded. It was simpler than trying to explain how Jack Endolini had happened to die blind and faceless beneath the tearing claws and ripping jaws of the Lobstrosities on the beach.
"The other bodyguard's George Biondi, Big Nose. I killed him myself. Will kill him 10 years from now."
Eddie looked as if he might faint in any second.
"Eddie, are you okay?" "I guess so. I guess I have to be."
They had drawn away from the bookshop's doorway. Oi was still crouched at Jake's ankle. Down Second Avenue, Jake's other, earlier self had disappeared.
"I'm running by now," Jake thought. "Maybe jumping over the UPS guy's dolly, sprinting all out for the delicatessen, because I'm sure that's the way back to Midworld, the way back to him."
Balazar peered at his reflection in the window beside the Today's Specials display board, gave the wings of hair above his ears one last little fluff with the tips of his fingers, then stepped through the open door. Andolini and Biondi followed.
"Hard guys," Jake said.
"The hardest," Eddie agreed.
"From Brooklyn."
"Well, yeah.
Why are hard guys from Brooklyn visiting a used bookstore in Manhattan?"
"I think that's what we're here to find out. Jake, did I hurt your shoulder?"
"I'm okay. But I don't really want to go back in there."
"Neither do I, so let's go."
They went back into the Manhattan restaurant of the mind. 9. Oi was still at Jake's heel and still whining. Jake wasn't crazy about the sound, but he understood it. The smell of fear in the bookstore was palpable. Deep Nose sat beside the chessboard, gazing unhappily at Calvin Tower and the newcomers, who didn't look much like bibliophiles in search of the elusive signed first edition. The other two old guys at the counter were drinking the last of their coffee in big gulps with the air of fellows who have just remembered important appointments elsewhere. Cowards, Jake thought, with a contempt he didn't recognize as a relatively new thing in his life. Low bellies. Being old forgives some of it, but not all of it.
"We just have a couple of things to discuss, Mr. Torren," Balazar was saying. He spoke in a low, calm, reasonable voice, without even a trace of accent. "Please, if we could step back into your office."
"We don't have business," Tower said.
His eyes kept drifting to Andolini. Jake supposed he knew why. Jack Andolini looked the axe-wielding psycho in a horror movie.
"Come July 15th, we might have business. Might. So we could talk after the 4th, I guess, if you wanted to."
He smiled, to show he was being reasonable.
"But now, gee, I just don't see the point. It's not even June yet, and for your information, my name's not..."
"He doesn't see the point," Balazar said.
He looked at Andolini, looked at the one with the big nose, raised his hands to his shoulders, then dropped them.
"What's wrong with this world of ours?" the gesture said. "Jack, George, this man took a check from me. The amount before the decimal point was a 1 followed by 5 zeros. And now he says he doesn't see the point of talking to me."
"Unbelievable," Biondi said.
Andolini said nothing. He simply looked at Calvin Tower, muddy brown eyes peering out from beneath the unlovely bulge of his skull like mean little animals peering out of a cave. With a face like that, Jake supposed, you didn't have to talk much to get your point across. The point being intimidation.
"I want to talk to you," Balazar said.
He spoke in a patient, reasonable tone of voice, but his eyes were fixed on Tower's face with a terrible intensity.
"Why? Because my employers in this matter want me to talk to you. That's good enough for me, and do you know what? I think you can afford 5 minutes of chit-chat for your 100 grand, don't you?"
"The 100,000 is gone," Tower said bleakly. "As I'm sure you and whoever hired you must know."
"That's of no concern to me," Balazar said. "Why would it be? It was your money. What concerns me is whether or not you're going to take us out back. If not, we'll have to have our conversation right here, in front of the whole world."
The whole world now consisted of Aaron Deepnoe, one Billy Bumbler, and a couple of expatriate New Yorkers none of the men in the bookstore could see. Deep Nose counterbuddies had run like the low bellies they were. Tower made one last try.
"I don't have anyone to mind the store. Lunch hour's coming up, and we often have quite a few browsers during..."
"This place doesn't do $50 a day," Andolini said. "And we all know it, Mr. Torren. If you're really worried you're going to miss a big sale, let him run the cash register for a few minutes."
For one horrible second, Jake thought the one Eddie had called Old Double Ugly meant none other than John Jake Chambers. Then he realized Andolini was pointing past him at Deepnoe. Tower gave in, or Torren.
"Aaron," he asked, "do you mind?"
"Not if you don't," Deepnoe said. He looked troubled. Sure you want to talk with these guys?
Biondi gave him a look. Jake thought Deepnose stood up under it remarkably well. In a weird way, he felt proud of the old guy.
Yeah, Tower said. Yeah, it's fine.
Don't worry, he won't lose his butthole virginity on our account, Biondi said, and laughed. Watch your mouth. You're in a place of scholarship, Balazar said, but Jake thought he smiled a little. Come on, Torin, just a little chat.
That's not my name. I had it legally changed on...
Whatever, Balazar said, soothingly. He actually patted Tower's arm. Jake was still trying to get used to the idea that all this melodrama had happened after he'd left the store with his two new books, new to him anyway, and resumed his journey. That it had all happened behind his back.
A squarehead's always a squarehead, right, boss?
Biondi asked jovially.
Just a Dutchman, don't matter what he calls himself.
Balazar said, If I want you to talk, George, I'll tell you what I want you to say. Have you got that?
Okay,
Biondi said. Then, perhaps after deciding that didn't sound quite enthusiastic enough,
Yeah, sure.
Good. Balazar, now holding the arm he had patted, guided Tower toward the back of the shop. Books were piled helter-skelter here. The air was heavy with the scent of a million musty pages. There was a door marked Employees Only. Tower produced a ring of keys, and they jingled slightly as he picked through them.
His hands are shaking, Jake murmured.
Eddie nodded. Mine would be, too. Tower found the key he wanted, turned it in the lock, opened the door. He took another look at the three men who had come to visit him, hard guys from Brooklyn, then led them into the back room. The door closed behind them, and Jake heard the sound of a bolt being shot across. He doubted Tower himself had done that. Jake looked up into the convex, anti-shoplifting mirror mounted in the corner of the shop, saw Deepnose pick up the telephone beside the cash register, consider it, then put it down again.
What do we do now? Jake asked Eddie. I'm going to try something, Eddie said. I saw it in a movie once. He stood in front of the closed door, then tipped Jake a wink. Here I go. If I don't do anything but bump my head, feel free to call me an asshole.
Before Jake could ask him what he was talking about, Eddie walked into the door. Jake saw his eyes close and his mouth tighten in a grimace. It was the expression of a man who expects to take a hard knock, only there was no hard knock. Eddie simply passed through the door. For one moment his moccasin-clad foot was sticking out, and then it went through too. There was a low, rasping sound like a hand being passed over rough wood. Jake bent down and picked Oi up.
Close your eyes, he said.
Eyes,
the bumbler agreed, but continued to look at Jake with that expression of calm adoration. Jake closed his own eyes, squinting them shut. When he opened them again, Oi was mimicking him. Without wasting any time, Jake walked into the door with the Employees Only sign on it. There was a moment of darkness and the smell of wood. Deep in his head, he heard a couple of those disturbing chimes again. Then he was through.